Scientology building. Back in the day, it was right. Yeah. It was real
small. UCB Franklin.
Yes.
It's right across the street.
Yeah.
From the Scientology building.
Right. I've seen that. There's always like a fucking line of people standing there, but I've never seen this facility here.
Have you gone to see a show ever?
No.
I feel like you would. It's like
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 100, yeah. Right? It's kind of his thing.
I think you'd like it.
Yeah, I think I would.
Would you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Can you put on these cans right here?
Sure.
Put on the cans, man.
Yeah, just putting so you can hear cans. Your sweet sensual voice.
Okay.
You can put it over your hat. You can do one of those cool, like, I'm a rapper.
Ooh, the rapper move might work with that hat.
Yeah.
It's not turning for me.
What do you mean?
There you go. This way.
What?
Oh. Help him, Christopher. Oh, there you go. Boom.
Oh, I was like, I don't know what's going on. Oh, I'm a little sad that
I feel like the hat's got
to
come.
You like the hat?
I feel like
it's hard to do.
I feel like you might be able to throw it on top.
I doubt it.
Might be able to. Does it look good?
Feels weird.
That does feel. That looks weird too. Yeah, did we fuck up your whole swag?
No, I think so.
I don't care.
No, I'm going to keep
brush my hair today.
I'm going
to
go like this.
I have a lot of hats. I have a lot of hats.
Are you? A hat guy?
Yeah, are you a man with hat? Don't you think you should be closer to your mic?
Oh, right.
You're in this.
I can't hear anything, so fine.
You're in this, Chris.
I can't hear shit.
Oh man, you're gonna be hunched over like that the whole time?
Oh no, I can just do this.
That's classic.
That's good.
That's classic.
Hey, welcome to The Price is Right. My name is Chris Covera. Gil, are you a hat person?
I'm a hat guy. Yeah.
What kind of hats? All kinds?
I have a bunch. I have some Stetsons and I have a bunch of shit. You know, like I have a lot of stuff. I've
heard that you're a bit of a Hordor.
I would call it a collector.
That's where George R. R. Martin got the name for that character. He was he was a hoarder.
Yeah.
He was a hoarder.
I would call it a collector, but yes, I have a lot of hats. I think, you know, there's something about, especially when I was younger, that immediate gratification of just buying shit for yourself. And as an actor, like ordering something online, you know, and then like all of a sudden it comes to your house, you're like it's a great transaction. You're like, "Oh shit. It's like Christmas every day." So for years I did that a lot.
But this is pre-Amazon, right?
This is pre-Amazon. I used to do eBay a fair amount, like lots of dumb shit on fucking eBay.
You've got to be on that Prime.
Drunk
right now.
eBaying was bad for me.
Trump?
Drunk eBay.
Oh, drunk eBay.
Oh yeah.
That sounds like a good podcast name.
Drunk eBay.
Drunk eBay.
What are the stupidest things you fucking bought?
I mean, I do drunk Amazon all the time.
Do you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Drunk Amazon's pretty big. But you can return Amazon easier than you can return eBay.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I shouldn't have fucking bought that.
So walk me through some. I mean, if I was to walk into your, you know, you have like some sort of a man cave situation.
Yeah, I do. I have like right? We call it the clown house. When you walk in there,
I want to go.
There's like
so
two
bad.
Giant racks of costumes. There's like costumes. I just set up a drum set. I had a guy that was living there for a little bit, about a year and a half. So he had a bed there, but that the space itself was the same. It's just all my shit. Mm-hmm. Like a giant Elmo head. I have.
Would you say
a giant Elmo head?
An Elmo head.
Yeah, yeah. Because I have like, you know, I'm a clown, so I have all these costumes and stuff. And then on the left is kind of a bar, and there's a piano that sucks and doesn't work completely well. Drum set in there now. Then there's a rack. There's a record player. A whole bunch of records. Except they're not in a case right now because when Nathan was leaving, I guess drunkenly one night, I was like, "Yeah, take that case. I don't need it." And now I'm like, "Fuck! I needed that case."
Yeah.
Are there any pictures of this that are accessible if Chris were to look it up? I would love to see it.
No, I probably have some stuff on my phone though. But if I don't know if there's like a, I thought about doing like an Airbnb because it's got a separate entrance, and so you could do like the clown house on Airbnb, and people could kind of come in. The only thing is we don't have a shower, which kind of sucks. It did have a shower and a stove, and right after I bought the place in 2010. I got cited for having that. So, and then around 2015, a guy was living back there. And then there's like, so where the shower was is like this sort of like empty Raiders of the Lost Ark space that I really didn't know about until a friend of mine was like, "Dude, you know, there's a giant sort of like chasm back there." So he cut
like this secret door type thing.
Yeah, oh yeah. So so it's like a mirror in the bathroom. And then so you just kind of push the mirror and the mirror pops open. And then you kind of step in. And it's probably about 5 feet deep and about 20 feet long. So I've got my computer. I got all my books.
Did you build it? You didn't build this?
No, it was there. So the shower was there. The reason why that the property right next to me, that wall is the property line. So according to whatever happened in 2010, and there's a lot of structures probably like this, I had to create 5 feet of like dead space because I guess it's like a fire hazard or something. So so there's like a, you know, the house is like that much less square footage because you legally have to have 5 feet to the property line. But I mean, you know, I guess I can't. I guess it's illegal that I have it, but I don't care. No one goes back there.
Right.
You know, I call it the dark side. I call it the dark side.
The dark side of the clown house?
The dark side, yeah. I just call it the dark side.
What do you
side.
Think that chasm was installed for? What do you think was going on before you moved
I
in?
I think a long time ago, maybe, when it was like, you know, this is probably a converted garage, like a lot of back houses are in Southern California. It was probably finished to the walls. There's actually some outlets and stuff, so it probably was just like a slightly bigger room. But then whenever they... whenever they flipped it, you know, and I before I bought it, maybe they had to create this sort of like, I don't know, fake sort of like thing.
So it doesn't feel like conspiratorial, like anything was being hidden back there.
No, but you definitely could hide shit back there. Mm. Yeah, every once in a while when I go back there, like I'm worried that like I see like a dead body or something. I mean, I would have had to have killed that person, you know. But it's kind of scary.
Oh, you're
like
worried
that.
About yourself leaving the dead body back.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like I was talking about this the other day with like dreams. You know, I don't know, but every 2 or 3 years I have that dream that involves a dead person. And in the morning I wake up and about an hour into the day, I'm like, oh, I didn't kill that person. Thank God. Thank God. I totally thought, because you remember the dream and you're like, oh, fucking, we're going to get rid of this wallet. And I don't know what that is. I'm not like a dream analyst.
Is it in the dream? Are you're killing in self defense, or is it?
I never kill the person. I just have the wallet, and I have kind of this sort of like the understanding that like, oh shit, I've done something. You know, kind of memento ish. Like,
yeah, where you see
what
red,
happened.
And you're like, oh no,
yeah,
my
yeah,
like pants I've, are torn.
Yeah, yeah, you have blood. All the indications that there was some foul play.
Yeah,
and you're like, I need to get rid of that body. You know, so it's just like I never actually do the stabbing or anything. You know, I just like it's after the fact.
Right.
I don't know.
It's
what
a
that
sort
is.
Of it's a sort of guilt that you're not sure how to process.
Right. Yeah.
Huh.
Do you ever look at your kids and you're like, oh, daddy's got to go away for a little bit?
No. No, I have a friend, though, a friend of a friend that just got put in jail and he had just had a baby. And I think, like, you know, I mean, it's hard not to, like, put yourself in that position because I've done some dumb shit. I mean, not presently, but, you know, just to think, like, God, that could have fucked it up for, like, everyone involved, you know?
You say you've done some dumb shit.
Oh, yeah, fucking for sure.
Like what?
Sure. Let's see. I mean, I guess maybe one of the dumbest things I did when I was 21, 22, there was a couple years I did lots of dumb stuff because I was just doing a lot of drugs and I was in Austin and doing a bunch of speed. And at one point, the guy that was a really good friend of mine in high school went and picked up a whole bunch of ecstasy and then and he left it in my car. And we were like doing speed for like 2 or 3 days. Like, and so, you know, if you've ever done drugs like that, especially speed, You're not eating, so your body becomes super depleted.
Right.
And so you take, like, shakes, just anything to get some food in you, you know, because you're just not hungry at all, you know. But, like, your body's like, dude, I need something. And so I just had a shake, and I got pulled over in Austin for having, like, I guess my inspection sticker or something. In Austin, they in Texas, they used to put it on the front of the window. So a cop saw it, pulled me over, and I was just, like, fucking petrified because that was – I'd probably been up for 3 days, you know, and it was just so fucking stupid. And I don't even think at the time I thought that all this X was in my back seat, which it was. Right. There were like 300 hits back there. I just, you know.
300 hits of ecstasy?
Yeah, 300 pills. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you get your hands on that?
I don't know how he did it.
You're really cool.
I don't know how my friend did it. Well,
he was selling then.
Yeah, yeah. He was a dealer. Yeah. And, I don't want to mention him by name. I haven't really reached out to him. And I don't even know where he is. I'll Google him every once in a while, but I don't know what happened to him. We had kind of a weird falling out because like he like pulled a gun on me. And then because I was picking up my bicycle, I was probably 22 at the time or 21, 22. And it was weird, but he kind of like pushed me away, you know. And it was good that he did that, you know. But it like totally affected me. It was like whatever. You know, it got me kind of out of that. That was right before I started the BFA program at UT. And then I started kind of like, you know, I couldn't go to class with like eight balls for eyes. So I, you know, I started stopped doing that.
UT is University of Texas.
Texas. Austin, yeah.
So, is that where you grew up, Texas?
Houston, yeah.
Houston?
I was born in New Orleans, and I grew up in Houston. Then I went to the University of Tennessee for a couple of years, and then University of Texas for 2 years, or 3 years.
How's that school? That's like a party. Is that like party central now?
I think any large university over 25,000 students is going
to
be.
I'm just thinking back to when I was looking at colleges, you know, 20, 21 years old, and you're looking for all the wrong reasons of why you would go to a particular school. And I literally remember searching for like the top 10 party schools.
Oh, really?
And I think I was thinking it was Texas, but now that I'm thinking about it, I think it was Arizona.
Oh, I've heard ASU or, University of Arizona. I've heard that.
I mean, this is back in 2009, though, so I'm sure things are different.
If you want a party, you'll find a party anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. So Texas, Houston.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Houston. I moved there when I was four or five, from New Orleans. My mom and dad were born and raised in New Orleans, so I think they wanted to get out. My dad was in the oil industry. And so we moved there, and I spent, up until 18. And then my dad still lives in Houston. My mom lives in Colorado now. She's moved around a little bit.
When did they separate?
I was 14.
14?
Yeah. Shit.
Do you think that...
Fuck yeah, fuck me out.
Well, I mean, of course. Yeah. But I was gonna more specifically ask, like, this... it seems like in your early days you had this incessant... purging that needed to come out of you. Like you say you did a lot of stupid shit. You're partying, doing lots of drugs.
I was actually a pretty good kid. I didn't drink in high school. Like not I didn't at all. Like I didn't even like my sister did a little bit. I have two sisters, but the one closest to me drank and partied. My dad was a drinker, and but he's very functional. He's but he likes to drink. Mm-hmm. And it's a family trait. I didn't do it for a long time. And then when I was in college, I was a diver. So springboard diving. I was with a bunch of swimmers.
You were a diver?
Yeah, I was a diver in college before I quit and started acting. So the first year and a quarter I dove. But I went to Tennessee. I was recruited to go to Tennessee, but I wasn't like given a free ride. I just was a walk-on. This coach was really good. And I knew of him, and I thought, I was really passionate about diving and stuff.
Whoa.
So there was a swimming team. They had a large, it was 12 freshmen, 11 swimmers that came onto the team, and then I was the one diver, And so, we all partied together, and they partied. I didn't party at all. There was this other guy named John McGowan, who I think he's in the military now, and he, when they'd go out on Fridays and Saturday nights, we'd just all sit around our dorm and be like, hey, what's up? And after a while, I was like, why am I doing this? Like, why am I not drinking and having fun? I'd never done it before. Oh. And then I was like, I feel like we should be doing something, and I wasn't bonding. I wasn't creating community with these other guys. They would go out and just, get drunk and stuff and right. smoke pot and that sort of stuff. So I started kind of going out. I started doing it. I started drinking. Like whatever pride I had to not do that was like once I was away from home, I was like, fuck it, And then, I really went after that, I drank a lot, and then, when I quit diving and I got into acting, I fell into groups, smoked more pot and did acid and stuff, and I got into the sort of jam band thing, and so I did all of that.
Started exploring yourself artistically.
Yeah, I started exploring, yeah.
What do you think that agreement with yourself came from prior to partaking in substances? Like you were sworn to sobriety in a sense, or
I 25 years later, as I think about it, I probably knew that I was predisposed to overdo it
because of your father.
Yeah, just because of everybody, everybody. Around me. I still have a difficult,
relationship
with that. Yeah. I'm not a moderate person, about anything.
Right.
There was,
and that's interesting because you're a diver.
Yeah.
You dove into things. You didn't just put your toes in. You dove head first.
That's true. I never thought about that.
Before we move on, diving, what's like the greatest height you dove from?
10 meters. I mean, I jumped from higher than that. They had these rock quarries in Knoxville. That's where I went to school. So the diving team that I was on, there was two seniors. Then there was me. And then there was like this other guy named Cliff, who was like maybe a year ahead of me. But he was kind of a walk-on. So there's like maybe four of us. And then my sophomore year, they got two more freshmen that were like pretty badass. Like one nationals, and the other guy was an Olympian from Zimbabwe. So we'd go to these rock quarries though, and you'd stand up. And I think the first quarry was like 70 feet or 80 feet, and then there was another one that was about 100, and then there was another one that was maybe like 130. So we all jumped off the 70, and then the 100 I wanted to do.
This is natural, right?
Yeah, just like these quarries. So these quarries in Tennessee, I guess they're there for mining or whatever else. So there's these gigantic cliff faces just into like a body of water, you know?
Holy shit.
And then you kind of climb back up.
That sounds fun.
It was
Chris is saying no.
It was super fun, man. It was super fun. And there was a group of people, and they're all divers. So like everybody will do it.
Are you guys doing it just to get chicks?
We never brought chicks out there. We never brought chicks out there.
So to get each other.
But there was chick divers. Divers have the best bodies, just like divers in general, because the guys or girls, swimmers can get a little brutish looking, you know, no offense swimmers out there. But, you know.
Our swimming communities.
Oh, man. Yeah, I know. That's like half our audience. Yeah, I know. But divers are just so shapely because you use like all the muscles walking down the board and spinning and twirling and stuff. So
really, I wouldn't have thought that because the activity is not a very long
activity. It is. Well, you train. I mean, you train a lot.
How do you train for diving?
I mean, you're doing so.
You just dive, right?
Yeah, but you're doing so. If you're doing big dives, what you might do for diving is they have trampolines. You'd also do belts on the board. They'll do that. Or belts? Tramp belts. Yeah, so there's belts that you can be actually. Most diving facilities will have a diving board that's on the dry land, and it has a mat, and they'll have a series of belts that kind of like hook into like an apparatus. So as you're going up and you're hurtling, you're in belts, so it'll help you kind of do the dive and kick out. So
it's almost like a slow motion effect.
A little bit. Yeah. So you can kind of get the feel in your body of like, okay, I can do that. So that's like a main.
That's interesting.
They use belts, a trampoline too. They'll have belts on a trampoline, so you'll get the feel too. And then for tower, any sort of Olympic size pool, if they're hosting anything nationally or any sort of meets, they're gonna have bubbles. So they have a bubble system in the bottom that kind of blows up bubbles, and it's good on a couple fronts. You can see the water because sometimes when you're like diving, just because it's clear, you can't quite see how far it is. So if you're doing like a back 3.5, you know, or inward 3.5 or whatever, or even like a back 1.5. You know, you can't see the water. Like, you don't know exactly like when it starts. You just see the bottom of the pool a little bit.
Really?
So divers will kind of bubbles will kind of break that up. So you're like, okay, that's where the water is. A lot of divers don't like bubbles, or not a lot. Some divers don't like bubbles because it tends to like throw your body in weird little ways. I mean, it's pumping all these bubbles up to the surface of the water. They'd rather just like do it or not do it.
How does one start with diving? You know, like. Other activities and sports, like you could see someone playing soccer and be like, oh, I want to try that. And you can just try soccer and you could suck at it or you might be good at it. Diving has a quality to it that seems rather dangerous or scary. There's like a real thrill aspect to it. Mm-hmm. How do you first dive?
Doing sweet gainers off of a quarry?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's
not,
it.
It's not completely untrue. There is a lot of jumping or like rope swings. Where I grew up in Texas, there's the Guadalupe River and stuff, not too far from Houston. So you're doing rope swings and doing little flips and stuff.
Right.
And I had a neighborhood pool where there was like a little 1 meter, and I would like run off and do a gainer or you know, like I kind of learned doing that. I had no form or like any sort of structure to it.
Were you pretty fearless though, like at that age, like?
I was pretty. Fearless for the most part, and the higher I got, the better I would do. So when I was doing 10 meter in college, but it was also the first time I was drinking, you know, and I was like a little hungover. So go out with the guys, if you're like all of a sudden Saturday mornings, you're like diving, you're like, oof, you know, and so the idea of like, you know, doing an inward 3.5 or back 3.5 when you're like a little bit like, eh, it's scary, you know. It's, I mean, if you're a kid and you're doing that stuff, I think you tend to be more fearless because you're not worried about the pain, you know. As you get a little bit more, as you get a little older,
conscious
and yeah, you're like, oof, this guy, I could really blow this, man. This could really hurt me.
Potential real repercussions here.
But I remember diving at my neighborhood pool, and there was an older guy that would dive, and he would only do like, you know, they call them like jackknives, but it's basically a jackknife is like a forward dive pike, which is like a 101B or something. That you jump up and you kind of touch your toes, the pike, and you kind of go down. But he was so beautiful, and like just the way that he would do it, he's probably in his 40s, you know, and I was just a kid. So when I got into high school, I saw that as a sport, like diving. And I was like, oh, I want to dive. I can do like a 1.5 and a gainer and stuff. And then so they took me in. This is in Spring Branch in Houston. And all of the – our school didn't have a pool, but all the Spring Branch schools had a pool called the Natatorium. And so they'd take us on a bus. I was the only diver in my high school, you know, take us on a
really?
Bus. Yeah. And then well, my friend Wally became a diver too. Like that was when I was a sophomore, he was a freshman and he got into diving. He ended up diving for University of Texas as well.
But, so if you're the only diver in your high school, like are there events just for you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's diving events for Spring Branch. So you'd represent, you know, I was Stratford High School, I'd represent my high school at larger events. I think like I went to state. I got like 15th or something on 1 meter. I wasn't like the higher up I went, the better I was, I think, you know. So like 1 meter, there's just some monsters that can like are just like just jacked and strong and they can like do like a front 3.5 on 1 meter, like no problem. I was never great at like that, just having that sort of crazy ass strength.
You see that Gail looked at me when he said that?
When he said what?
He's like, some people are just jacked. That made me feel real good. Thanks for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I'm going to throw a bone your way. But so, yeah, so that's how I got into it. And because I was the only diver and, you know, I could do a couple tricks, you know, I was like a 4-year letterman. Like I got letter every year, freshman year, sophomore year. And, you know, I took it to college. And then it was, you know, I've told this story before, but it was when I got into college, I was my sophomore year. So I would go out with these freshmen and they're all sweet dudes, I guess. Some of them are, you know, the freshmen were all pretty cool. The older classmen were kind of jerks. They'd go out to bars and stuff and they'd just get like wasted and, you know, we'd walk home and I'd see some of these guys like run and jump on. This was West Campus in Tennessee, Knoxville. And just jump on cars and stuff, like, and just like totally dent these hoods, you know, like just randomly walking back to our dorms, like they call it like gum dropping or something. I don't know. They jump on these hoods and it would just like bend the crap out of, you know, I was like, fuck, dude, that's horrible, man. Yeah. That's someone's car. So, you know, as I was doing this and they would like pee in like cups and try to give them to girls and stuff. I mean, it was just like adolescent behavior, but part of me was like not cool with that sort of stuff. Like I didn't think it was funny. I wasn't, you know, like I had never been around so many jocks before, you know. I wasn't really a jock. I was a diver, but to me it wasn't really jockey.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't, you know, but then I all of a sudden I'm thrown into like a university and I'm with these guys and it feels very like jocular and I'm not comfortable with it. So I took an acting class and then that was my sophomore year. And there was like a group of 16 and I was the only dude. And I was like, these are pretty good odds.
Wow, you're really, so far in your story, you're the only dude a couple times.
I was the only dude. That's how I win. That's how I get first. You got to be the only guy to get first. And then so I did acting class, and I really liked it. And then I got put in this play, this Peter Schaffer play called Royal Hunt of the Sun. And it was at the Clarence Brown Theater, which is like kind of a regional theater in Knoxville. And so it kind of runs that little regional theater pipeline. They had a couple sort of equity actors that lived in Knoxville that would probably do every show that they always did. Mm. And they'd hire some other equity contracts from New York. It's not that far to do this show. This show specifically was a group named Diablo Mundo. And it was they were doing a co-production. And it was this Argentinian acting troupe. Royal Hunt of the Sun is basically Pizarro like coming over and like the capturing like all the Aztecs and stuff. It's that sort of story. So, I've never seen another production of it. And I was just like a spear shucker kind of in this show.
What do you mean by that?
Like, you know, just like a guy with a spear kind of in like, literally like a spear shucker. I maybe had a couple lines, but the group itself, after the shows were done, would go to a restaurant and they would like, they would, you know, they like in any acting group, like they take over the restaurant, you know, and they just, they'd be loud and people were like, oh my God, but you didn't care. They'd be singing songs and it was really fun. And I remember like being, you know, like totally at ease with this group of people. And it was like this big aha moment for me because I thought like, oh man, this is my tribe. Like this is my tribe, not these other guys. This is who I'm supposed to be with, you know? So at that point I quit diving. I just totally quit. I told my coach and I cried and he was like, and he said something that that was really, you know, I was my beginning of my sophomore year. There were some other sort of politics with it. Like I wasn't traveling as much as I wanted to. I was working my ass off. And then, you know, but it's that failure as a diver. Cause I really did love it. I loved doing it. And I started it like my freshman year in high school. So like it's kind of late for a diver to kind of start it there. A lot of divers are like gymnasts, and then like once they kind of age out of gymnastics, they dive because the most difficult for them is to learn how to land on their head. You know, that's because you don't do that as a gymnast.
Oh yeah.
So the majority of gymnasts, you know, or majority of people typically were gymnasts that got into it, or started when they were just a kid and fearless. But I did it when I was a freshman in high school, just because I was looking for something to do. And I'll get back to that. But I told Dave, you know, that I want to quit. And I remember him looking at me. He's like, you know, I think you're a lot better than you think you are. And I was like, it's just not, you know, for me, it's like, it's just not good enough. You know, I don't, you know. And he's like super disappointed, you know, it's understandable. And then so I rode the rest of that year. I started taking more acting classes. I did that play. And then after that, I wasn't diving for University of Tennessee anymore. So I was like, well, I'm going to transfer to Texas, you know? And so I did. I think I had to come in and do some summer school because my SATs weren't high enough or something. So, but then I got in there and I had kind of a rocky year where I kind of did a lot of drugs and stuff. And then at that point, I didn't know anybody. I was totally alone. I was like in North Austin at some little apartment. You know, at the time it seemed pretty bleak. But
what year is this roughly?
This would have been 1994. 94, 95.
Was Austin sort of the cool hip place?
It was cool. I mean, for sure. Everybody in Austin always says, I should have been here 10 years ago. That's always like that. So in the 90s, it probably was like, oh, I should have been here in the 80s. And then those guys are like, I should have been here in the 70s. That's when it was really cool. But it was great. I mean, I do love Austin. I miss it. But, you know, there's just more to do out here. But then that's when I got into the BFA program. I auditioned and then and I got in. And it was just like another one of these sort of like, I hadn't been acting very long. Like, you know, I never saw musicals. In fact, the first monologue I did for the BFA class, once I got in, I did a monologue. I was living with one of my buddies, Todd Lowe, who I'm still good. He's a working actor and I'm still good friends with him. That's why he does, hey, do monologue from Our Town. And I was like, okay. I didn't read the play because I was just like trying to cram the monologue into my head. I still never read the play. I was reading George, I think, and it was like on a park bench. And again, I don't know anything about this play, but I memorized the monologue as quick as I could. And then the next day in class, because I had to do it the next day, you know, it's the first day of our BFA classes. And then Lee Abraham, who was the instructor for this class, was like, okay, you know, who wants to go first? And, you know, like no one's raising their hand. I'm like, dude, fuck this. And so I raised my hand. He's like, great, go up there. And I do the monologue or as much of the monologue I do. And then so Lee's got some questions for me. And he's like, okay, you know, how old is George? He already doesn't like my selection. And that was kind of like an ongoing thing for the next 2 years is Lee was never very, very smitten with me. And because I probably looked like I hadn't done any of the work because I literally hadn't ever, you know.
Yeah.
I still don't do scenes that bring props. You know, like I try to stay away from stuff like that. It's like, oh, I got to bring that shit? I don't want to do that. So So he asked me all these questions, and at one point, I just answer all of them wrong. Like, how old is this guy? He's like, oh, 15. You know, he's like, just. And then he's like, just sit down, man. Just sit down. You know? And it was like, and that was my beginning.
What do you mean he cut you off?
No, just like after answering the questions wrong, and everybody else is like, oh, God, because they've seen our town, because it's like this thing you do in high school, or you know, somewhere you've come across this play. And I literally had no idea. And I'm trying to like just guess the correct answer in the moment. And I'm just clueless about it. But, you know, up until that point, the only monologue I had ever memorized was in a monologue book, which is the monologue I memorized to do Royal Hunt of the Sun. So, like, I really didn't have any preparation.
Maybe I missed something. I'm a little confused. I thought you were doing a monologue. You're answering questions?
Afterwards. So he's after, you know, the monologue. He's like, okay, hey, let's talk about your character.
What's it about?
Yeah, exactly. What do you think you're saying?
Analyzing.
But he's just asking like simple questions like, you know, how.
But did your performance go well?
I don't know. But he was like, you're not. I mean, the thing about class and the way I feel about almost any class is that like, I mean, this is, I don't know if I'm still believe this, but this is something I've been saying for years. Like that acting, the BFA program there, they basically take all your clothes and then they get them dry cleaned. And at the end of the 2 years, they give them back to you. And you're like, see, those feel better, don't they? You know, I don't know if I learned a whole bunch of shit there, you know, but I just learned more about like what I do. You know, or like the things that, you know.
It was a space for you to work out.
Yeah, it's tough, you know. And I didn't have any sort of like, you know, I was coming into it very, very fresh and very new. So
I have I'm similar in how I stumbled into acting, in the sense that like I didn't ever do theater in high school. Uh-huh. I wasn't ever interested in acting in any way until I went to college, and I just was picking what sounded fun to me,
Yeah.
I knew I was into movies, so I picked acting on film, and I picked a film class.
Yeah, yeah.
And same thing, like I had no sort of techniques or ideas of how to do what I was doing.
Right.
But I think that actually worked in my favor. It sounds like it might have ultimately worked in your favor too. But yeah, I didn't have any preconceived notions on how to go about it. In fact, now that I'm saying this out loud for the first time, I'm realizing my technique, I think, in acting, in that acting in film class, was just stealing.
Oh yeah.
Like I remember I did a monologue from Entourage. I think that was my first ever time acting, now that I'm thinking about it. I did Ari Gold.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I did
a fucking course. You did Entourage, you simple bitch.
Yeah, exactly, though, because I was, you know, I wasn't artistically inclined at that point, or really knew what I was doing, and I was watching Entourage. It was on at the time, you know.
Yeah,
and
juicy.
I really connected to those types of characters, those sort of over the top, overachiever type people. And I remember which one it was too. It was the one where
why don't you perform it for us right now?
Can you do it?
I'm wondering if I could. It's the one where him and his wife are seeing a therapist.
Uh-huh.
Every like few episodes, they would like do a scene of him and his wife at the marriage counseling. And I wouldn't be able to do it. But it's basically like he's saying like,
it's me, Ari Gold.
Yeah, he's like, oh man, it's so close. The whole thing's like, you know what I mean? It's like so close. But he's basically saying like, you know, like I got like wife number two, therapist number seven. He's they're both kind of ganging up on Ari for not being present in the relationship. And he's just kind of going over about all the stuff he's got going on. But I swear, I'm like one, if I could remember the beginning, I could do the whole thing. But
it's in a cold open, I think you're thinking. Cause it's,
it might be.
It's, they open it up and it's like, so Ari, you know, your wife here is trying to talk to you about certain things, and then he goes off on this big like, "This is bullshit. I'm better than this."
You and think? I'm so close to having it.
And then we're gonna put it in the episode afterwards. But I know this.
Pull it up for me.
You're not gonna be able to hear it, but
I'm not gonna be able to hear it.
Maybe?
If I can just get the beginning, I'll remember it.
Sure. I can't spell Entourage.
I don't, cause I don't care Fuck, it's right there. I'm not. I don't know.
All right, I'll give you. I'll feed you the first line. How about that?
You know which one I'm talking about?
Yes.
This is exciting, guys. I'm gonna watch some real acting here.
Oh, yes.
I don't know about that.
What is this guy's name? You know?
Ari Gold?
No, the actor.
Oh yeah, it's
Jeremy Piven.
Jeremy Piven.
Jeremy Piven. Oh, yeah.
I've worked with him before.
Yeah.
Is on what?
This called Keeping Up with the Steins. It was Gary Marshall's son, Scott Marshall, directed this movie in 2007, and Jeremy Piven was in it, and Jamie Gertz was in it. I got to be in Daryl Hannah and a whole bunch of other people. Daryl Sabata was in it as well. He was kind of the kid, and it was basically I played a film crew of like. They're, you know, I guess taking video or B-roll of this kid's bar mitzvah that's going to happen. That's kind of what the whole thing is.
I'm shocked.
Jeremy Piven was the dad. And at one point, I'm the camera guy, and there's a sound guy, and there's this other guy. Is it right here?
Yeah, I got it for you. Keep going.
I'm the camera guy, and I'm taking pictures of the camera, and Jeremy Piven walks up to me. And Jeremy Piven is, no disrespect, that he's a very talented dude, but he's one of those guys that wouldn't, at least at that time, wouldn't necessarily know your name, but he'd know all the names of the female extras, you know?
Hell yeah.
That's just kind of the way
I've heard some stories.
That's
as
just
well.
The way he rolls. But, you know.
Did he get, I think he got like half Me Too'd.
And oh, did
it
he?
Was one of those Me Too's that went away real quick.
Oh, maybe.
Like, he just got me'd.
He got like.
I never had an issue with him other than so he at one point
it's a James Franco Me Too. Go ahead.
I'm videotaping it but trying to do it on the sly and he comes up to me and he slapped and it's a working camera. And the way they sold it to me is like, you got some footage, you know, we'll put it in sort of thing. So he slaps the camera and the camera flies out of my hand and kind of hits the ground. I'm like, oh shit, dude. Like that's like a expensive working camera.
Whoa.
And then you know, at the time, I'm telling the story now. And at the time, I was really embarrassed by it. You know, and he comes and he goes, dude, you got to hold on to that camera. Like, why did he just slap the camera out of my hand, man?
Oh, so he blamed it on you?
Yeah. He's like, you got to hold on to it, man. I was like, well, dude, you slapped it out of my
hand.
How
old were you?
I mean, this was 2007, so I was like early 30s.
Were you working a lot at that time, or were you pretty new to it?
I always worked a fair amount commercially. I didn't do a lot of theatrical stuff early on. Like at the beginning of my career, I did like some leads in some movies in Austin in 99. And then I did a movie called Boys Don't Cry. At the time, it's called Take It Like a Man. But I had two scenes with Hilary Swank. She ended up winning the Oscar for that. I was like her deceased dad. So there's these little flashback scenes, you know? Mm. So it was kind of like a big deal. And I remember.
I want to see this.
I was cut out of the movie. I still get residuals for it. But I remember
you were
going,
cut out of the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Hold off.
I remember going to the
Hilary
theater.
Swank's not enough for me. I need Gil.
I remember going to the theater with my little sister, Kelsey, my little sister, and like, you know, watching the movie saying, God, I mean, she'd already gotten some Oscar buzz and stuff. And as I watched the movie, I was like,
Is that how you found out?
Yeah. I mean, it's okay. There was a lot of people in Austin, but that Taft-Hartley'd me. So after 99, 2000 kind of rolled along, and I was working in a tile store called Arcaterra in Austin, and I was just like miserable. My eye was twitching because I had a bad coworker, and my girlfriend at the time was
your
like,
"Your eye was twitching because you had a bad coworker."
Yeah, she was horrible, and it made my eye twitch.
Wow, you got to be pretty shitty to make someone else's body part have
spasms. I've never had that happen before.
I've been trying to get Yoshi's eye to twitch.
Oh, really? Yeah. You really got to like it was weird. It's just twitching.
Not easy to irritate on that level. I wonder if, can we track her down? I want to see if she still has that effect on you. Imagine like she walks in the room and you're just like,
I know her name. I know her name. Well, she was upset.
What's
because.
Her name? Tell everybody.
Her name is Nita. I'll leave out Anita. She was like older and, you know, it was, I don't know, it was weird. But at the time, and I was selling tile and stuff. And so I figured, you know, like, what am I? But, you know, honestly, that tile job, every job that you do, everything you do gives you kind of like another, or you're at least able to take away a story from it, because I've thought a lot about like selling tile, which I did for a little bit. And, you know, for me, if me as an actor, if I were a piece of tile, people would come into the store and I'd try to sell them tiles that I like. you know, because it's good quality or I like the way it looks and stuff. And sometimes they'd like it, sometimes they wouldn't, sometimes they'd get whatever they wanted. That's because that's what they like, you know?
Right.
So I've always thought when I first came here, I thought like, you know, I'm just like a piece of tile. Some people like the tile that I am. Some people like different tile, you know? Mm. Doesn't make this tile bad. I know what I like, you know, I like this quality tile, but not everybody's going to see, you know, or the price point's going to be more interesting to them, or, you know, or the fact that they can get a lot of it for, you know.
And you know what happens different. If you get a lot of, you know, nice tiles where the patterns sort of match when put together? You know what you get, guys?
What?
You get a nice floor.
You do get a nice
And that's
floor.
What we got going with the theater troupe that we just, we've got a lot of synchronized tiles.
God.
And we're creating a nice floor. No, I like that analogy, the tile.
I feel like of the tile, of the class that we're currently in, I'm popcorn ceiling because I do not fit.
I know you fit. You fit just fine.
You
it's
fit
great.
Perfectly. What are you talking about?
I just wanted to use the popcorn ceiling.
I like
I don't even know
it's
that.
It's not even tile.
What's
though?
Popcorn ceiling? Ceiling?
It's just a terrible joke.
Yeah. It's when you have... Oops.
You're good.
It's when you have... it's like that... I don't know. It's like spackle or something that's on the roof. Yeah, I don't know why they do that.
Like in classrooms, kind of?
Yes, classrooms that have it.
Yeah, it's for insulation, technically.
All right, let me look at this.
All right.
This oh, my your, God, dude. Yeah. I haven't seen this in over 10 years. Yeah, everybody stop. I didn't go to the Lakers game because they're playing the fucking Bobcats. And I came here today because I thought this was a session on how my wife could learn how to communicate, how to answer a question without a question. Basic humanity 101. Which I thought, given your wall of fucking diplomas, that you could easily fix. Or if you couldn't, you could give her a pill that would either fix it or make her a mute. But now, to turn around and gang up on me, I have work to do. I have hundreds of clients to deal with, and just so we're clear, I don't care about any of them. They're all just a number, like wife number one and therapist number seven. Good day.
That's really good. Yeah.
No, that
just,
was.
It was just like Jeremy Piven.
that's like, I think, I'm not kidding when I said I stole it. Like, when I did it in the class, I just did it the same way he did it. And nobody knew.
I think that's the beauty about any sort of thing. Everybody's a thief in Hollywood. Everyone steals from somebody.
This like is everyone, true.
You know, there's not, you just.
And you can call it inspiration, but.
Yeah, or, you know, or I think what happens, like, as when I'm a songwriter, and so I'll do songs, and, you know, I'll write a song.
Do you go lyrics or music first?
Usually if I've had a drink or something, I smoked a little pot, sometimes I'm just playing my guitar, and I find a progression I like, you know, and I'm like, whoa, and then I start writing, like, the chorus or what the verse would be.
Right.
I'd say that's probably more often how I do it. But, I mean, I've done it before where I've just, like, I've written a couplet or a word and then like, you know, and it feels like when I'm trying to put it, transcribe it musically, it's like it starts sounding like a song I already do a little bit. So then I just started, but I still want to keep that sort of phrasing. So I try to find a different way to, like, play it, you know. But,
like you could pick it or you could strum it or
something. Or just different chords or try it in a different chord. I have a thing where, you know, and I'm probably not the only person, but as a songwriter, like as a guitar player, I tend to write in G a lot. Like that's my first sort of like thing to go. And now I've done two kids albums. I'm kind of working on my own sort of solo music and gearing up for another kids album. So I'm conscious of the fact that I'm doing a bunch of songs in G all the time. And I don't want them on the record to be like in, you know,
all G.
Yeah. So I'm like, if I try to go any chord, but G is usually where I try to like,
just to branch out a little bit.
Just to do something.
Please, better. Your next album, I should say, should be Guilford, whatever your last name is.
What is your last name?
Adams.
Guilford Adams.
Guilford Adams. It's a nice name.
Oh, thanks, man.
In the, what is it? Not the song.
Songs in the chord.
In the key of G.
That's good.
Because, song. And then you should highlight your.
And not one of them is
G. Not. But the kids would never know.
I've thought about that.
How many, you have kid albums?
Like, I have two. Yeah, I have two. So I had written a bunch of kid songs over the, I'm a clown, so I
yeah, I'm a terrible host. Gil's a clown.
So I play my guitar at parties and stuff. And just over the years, I wrote kids songs. I don't know why I did it. I did. I think the first one I wrote was probably... I'd written songs before that, but I think my first kid song was maybe like 2006 or something there, maybe 2005. And so that's a lot of those songs. Once my boys were born, I have twins that are 2.5. My wife was like, you should put those songs together on an album, you know? And so, and we'll give it away for their first birthday. So I did that. And that was in 2018 was my first album. I handed them out. And when you record an album and you go through CD Baby or whatever, then they do a distribution so then it can go to iTunes and Spotify, and it's like an extra $80 and it can just like disperse the music everywhere.
Yeah.
Which is what you should do, you know, because no one listens to CDs anymore. I have CDs just because if you tell somebody like, hey, you should listen to Gilly Adams, or, you know, they're like,
Gilly?
Gilly Adams, yeah.
Is that your clown name?
G-I-L-L-Y and then Adams, A-T-O-M-S.
Gilly Adams.
I just figured it's easy.
It's hot.
You know, Gilly Atoms.
It also has a feminine, like if I only heard Gilly Adams, I would think it was.
Oh, really?
I would probably think it was a girl.
Yeah, I think my wife didn't
like
love it. Yeah?
I like it. No, I really do.
I'm the kind of clown.
What are you laughing at? This Gilly.
Gilly Adams, yeah. Does sound like a drag queen. I'm sorry.
A drag queen?
Oh, I like it.
I dig it.
Gilly Atoms. Gilly Adams.
Gilly Adams. But, you know, I've always, like my name is Guilford. I go by Gil. But since I answer the phone all the time as a clown, I just say, hey, this is Gilly, you know? Other than, like, Mr. Pickles, or I've got a friend named Laffy Pants, which is great, and he can pull it off.
Do you guys have clown get-togethers, like clown conferences?
I mean, we get together. I haven't seen him in a while. We all used to work on a job together, so we'd see each other a lot more than we see each other now.
Laffy What's Pants? Going on, Chris?
I'm sorry, okay? Laffy Pants is killing me.
You're Laffy Pants.
LaffyPants.com. He's a real clown.
He's LaffyPants.com.
LaffyPants.com. He's a good friend of mine.
Oh, my God. This is amazing.
Laffy Pants.
Do you want to maybe...
No, L-A-F-F-Y.
Oh.
After we look up your friend, do you want to maybe show us one of these kids' songs?
Sure. I can do that. Here's LaffyPants.com.
LaffyPants.com. See if his site is up.
He hasn't. See if he neglected to put it back up. Oh, there it is.
That's wow.
Oh, my God.
Are we going to be able to superimpose this?
Yeah, I'll be able to throw it up there.
That's LaffyPants.com.
LaffyPants.com. Rated LA's...
Well.
That was when he was a kid. Every clown has
rated
a picture.
Rated LA's top clown by ABC's Eye on LA.
Wow.
This comes as no surprise with 15 years of fun and folly under his belt. Laffy Pants is the difference between a party and a really fun party.
He's really good. He's a really good clown.
He was really the top clown?
I don't know if that's true, but he has a skill set. He's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. He can do everything. A lot of clowns, if you're a clown and you came from Ringling Brothers or whatever, you're not going to have balloon twisting skills, and you're not most of them. I'm not going to say all of them, but a lot of Ringling clowns, when it was more, you know, they once you work under the big top, you don't want to do kids' parties. You know, that's, I'm not saying they all think that, but that's kind of the gist that you get. They'll
once
go
you,
to circ-
once you work what?
What like the big top? Like,
what's
what
the
do,
big top?
Ringling circus. Brothers. Yeah, the circus. Yeah.
Once you go circus, you
which,
never
no,
go back.
But it's no longer here. You know, so 2017, the circus closed once they got rid of the elephant. So all those clowns were out of a job. But then they went to other circuses. I bet some of them went to Cirque du Soleil. Very few of them probably went to backyards to do kids' parties because it's a different, there's an overlap in the skill sets, but I also think that some people don't, it almost feels like a step backwards once you've done the circus. To
sure.
Do kids though. And I think a lot of circus clowns that I know aren't particularly good with kids. It's a weird thing to say, but a lot of like the clowns like don't, aren't good with kids. When you have to be one-on-one with a kid and like you started doing birthday parties and stuff and like that was kind of your bread and butter, you know how to interact with kids. The big circus clowns, like you're doing it for adults and stuff. The kids are just byproducts. You know, you're doing big shows. Like you got big makeup. People can see you from really far.
And is it more like technique that showed off at those bigger shows?
I think it's just different broad comedy. You know, it's not like you don't have near the wordplay, the little stuff you say with kids, you know.
Right.
I mean, there's no reason to have, like you just you don't develop that skill set. You don't develop the skill set of doing face painting. You don't develop the skill set of doing balloon animals just because. I mean, you don't need to. No one asks you to do that.
What do you? What's your specialty? What do you do?
I'm a performer. You know, I think it's my specialty. I mean, and then I think music. I cater to the parents too. Like I have a lot of jokes sometimes. Actually, being a dad, I've really warmed into, I think, a more compassionate clown. It's weird to say that. I think when I was younger, like, okay, for example, I used to, before I went to a clown party, I would always take a bong hit, like always. And then once I became a dad, I thought like, why am I doing that? Like, why? I would want someone to come stoned my clown, you know, and I just did it out of habit. And I literally, for the past 2 years, and I did it because I've probably done 5,000 parties over the years. I've done a lot of kids' parties.
So gotta just mix it up.
You gotta mix it up. You do like two keep parties, and all of a sudden, you know, before that third party, you like take a little toke or something.
Give yourself something to contend with while you're in
there.
It's
just like it breaks it up a little bit, you know? But then, I don't know, I got to the point where like, and I would do it before I would even think about it. Like, you know, I would just like, I was like, hey, I'm not going to smoke pot. And all of a sudden, I'm in the back house. I'm taking a bong. He's like, Joe, I told myself I wasn't going to do this. Like, it was such a weird habit of like that, you know? And then, but honest, for 2 years, maybe over 2 years, I have not smoked at all before a clown party.
Yeah.
And I like it. I can't believe I used to do that so much, you know? I'm a much better clown than I used to be. And I don't know. So I'm a little bit more, the older version of Gilly was a little bit more like an uncle that would kind of like fuss the kid's hair, like not physically, I would never really touch the kid's hair, but you know, kind of like screw with him a little bit. And then, you know, maybe not being the most compassionate, you know, that maybe kids at the end of it were like, I kind of felt like he was making fun of me. I mean, seriously, like I would. I've said everything at a kid's party.
You
like,
were a Don Rickles clown.
A little bit. Because you would have, I've said everything to kids, you know. I've been like, and at the time, you know, I thought it was funny and stuff. And as I've gotten a little bit older and, you know, I let that stuff go away. Like if there's a bad kid, I used to have this line. If it was like, hey, little guy, can you show me where your mom is or your mom or dad is just so I can privately judge them? You know, because they were just getting like being like an asshole. Like, dude.
You would say that?
Yeah. Like, I say it loud for them to hear. Like, hey, where's your mom or dad?
So you're doing that for the parents to laugh.
Yes. No. For them to be like, get your kid. Why is he going through my stuff? You know, like.
Oh.
Because he's being kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
And now at this point, that kid could be autistic. He could be, who knows what could be wrong with that kid. Because
you're leading with compassion. You're leading
with empathy. Done that before. And then the mom came up and said, like, well, he's autistic. I was like. Oops. Well, give me a little information, you know. Yeah. I mean, like, thanks for your help, lady. You know, but it's like, you know, once you make that sort of like screw up, you're like, okay, well, I don't do that again.
Yeah,
you know, I've been like drunk at a party before, which I was, and that was like, it was horrible, and you know, I just thought like, I'm never doing that again, like ever. You know, I was much freer with like smoking a little pot, and thinking like, you know, no one really knows, but like I've never. And the only other time I maybe had a beer once at a lunch and then went and did a party and I just felt like maybe they could smell it or something. Now, that being said,
yeah,
I'm sure the morning after partying a lot, you know, and I used to do that a lot, it'd be Saturdays and Sundays, I probably smelled like booze. But I wouldn't wake up and drink booze, to you know, but I probably had like permeating kind of like, that clown smells a little lived in.
When that was happening, did you ever feel like you were falling into like a specific archetype of a man? Like you've heard this story before of this type of person, or you've seen it in films of like the guy who's
It's really arced up. Yeah, it's a very
the
much.
Guy who's out late the night before, sort of abusing himself, and then shows up to entertain little children.
Yeah,
and then kind of feels shitty about himself.
Yeah, for sure. But the only thing worse than that is not to show up, you know? I mean, I've always been, as much as I feel like I've needed to, you know, embrace a different level of sobriety, I've always, like, made it to work, you know? Like, to me, that's, like, the real death nail. And, like, you've got a problem if you're skipping work, you know?
Yeah.
As long as you're showing up.
Sure.
You know, maybe it's you still got control of it, you know? But it's, I mean, it's that's kind of a smokescreen, really.
Right.
But
do you feel like, because as I'm getting older, like for whatever reason, well, it's natural. As you get older, more and more children appear in your life through friends, kids, through whatever means that is. And I've had ample opportunity in the past year or two to really sort of try to develop an understanding of how to communicate with children and how that process looks. And because there's no hiding from them. Once they're past a certain age, like, there's no hiding from them. Like, yeah, like, they're looking at your authentic self.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like at times like you're being tested to be your authentic self in order to properly commune with them. And I've had practice at that, and I feel like I'm getting really good at it. And that's a long-winded way of me asking you. You've had tons of time with little kids. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you have seen things that most people don't see, or you have some kind of special ability to get inside their heads and see the beauty of their innocence, et cetera, et cetera?
I've always been, you know, I don't know, for whatever reason, I've always enjoyed the company of kids, you know, like being around them. If I'm at a party and there's a bunch of adults talking, like, I'll immediately go to the kid and start talking with the kid, like, what's going on? And it's stupid jokes sort of thing, you know. I've just always been like that. Maybe part of it because I felt like I can, like, spar with them a little bit, and other people notice, or like, oh God, he's really good with kids sort of thing. And that's kind of like, that's, you know, kind of good bait for girls. I don't know. You know, maybe part of that was that. But, you know, as far as, you know, having kids of my own, like, other people's kids is like, you know, it's easy. And you're only dealing with those kids for, like, you know, like an hour out of the day, or like an hour and a half or 30 minutes. It's way different when you have two kids you're dealing with for 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
Your patience and, you know,
it's tested.
You're not like Mr. Fun. Like, I bet my kids would be like, how are you a clown? Like, you're just mean. Like, I have no idea. Like, kids like you? Like, really? Like, we don't like you. You know, I hope they don't say that, but, you know, there's just your dad most of the time. But there is that sort of, you know, from, you know, the morning when they wake up, 6 or 7 a.m. to, like, you know, 8 or 8:30 or 9, you know, and then you're kind of in that dad zone, you know. But then when they go to bed, you know, it's like, okay, great, I can be me again for a little bit. Like, maybe I go take a little bong hit or have a drink, play some guitar and stuff, and then get to bed at, you know, 10:30, 11. So you got 2 hours for you, you know, that you have to, like, well, for you and your wife,
sure,
or your partner, whoever it is.
Is there anything, are there any moments that you might be able to recall from clowning around, where you learned something from a kid, or there was some sort of a special moment?
Probably too many to kind of, like, choose from. I mean, the kids are, like, strangely compassionate, you know, like, they're almost like, they can be super cruel as well, but kids, and they're very literal, like, everything you say, you know. But specifically, as far as, there's, without, like, a singular story that, like, because there really is, like, a bunch. I don't know how to, it's like, say, hey, what's your favorite song from any band? Like, I don't, and not that it's a bad question, I just don't know how to get specific with it, because it's sure, kind of all, like, just feels like a fog in my head. But I don't.
Why don't we do a kid song?
Yeah,
kid song.
Gil brought his guitar, and he's gonna play one of the aforementioned kid tunes that he wrote for one of his albums.
So this is I wrote this song a while ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago.
You can pull that out if you want. Wherever you want to put it, yeah.
And then my kid's album, this is like the title track, called Larry Caterpillar, Larry the Caterpillar. Larry the Caterpillar was crawling on the ground. He had little feet on him. Crawled, made no sound. Crawled down the hopes someday he'd be found. When the sun come up, he'd be there, traveling from sea to sea, up shades of grass and big white rocks, settled upon a tree. climbed up to the highest branch, he just fell to sleep. Now, boys and girls, when these caterpillars, they form these white sleeping bags. I think they get them from Costco. And they call them a chrysalis. It's not called a cocoon. My wife's corrected me. It's called a chrysalis. When Larry woke up from a long, long sleep, he had grown some wings. With a flap, flap here and a flap, flap there, flew above the trees. Last time I looked outside, even further than I could see. Now don't you worry about the Larrys that crawl upon the ground. With a little, little luck, they'll grow up big, travel from town to town. You and I will gaze up high, watch them dance all around. I said you and I will gaze up high, watch them dance all around.
Hey, there's the caterpillar. Feel like a small child right now. That was amazing.
Oh, that was great, man. I love your voice.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I'm a little bit, I told you, I've had some allergies, so my voice is...
It's sort of working. It's working.
Well, here's the... I'll do one more. So yeah. I've been working on some adult stuff. I always do. I wrote this song a little while ago. The cool thing about writing songs, you play music, right, Yosh? Mm-hmm. Do you play music as well? Well, the nice thing about it, when you're like in between residuals and checks, is you can like, or you're feeling down about yourself, you can write a song or you can play guitar, then you can like, if it comes to you, Neil Young talks about it like the gift, you know, when the gift comes and it's like, whether your gift is writing or drawing or whatever else, like there's like a window where like something feels like it happens, you got to drop everything you're doing and then you got to like start to work on it. The inclination is you're watching TV or something, and the gift doesn't come around when you're watching TV. The gift usually comes around in idle times. So, you know, it doesn't come around when you're flipping through fucking, you know, Twitter or on, you know, that's not when the gift arrives. The gift arrives when you have a moment of like just nothing, and then an idea pops in your head. And a lot of people will like, they'll talk themselves out of like getting up and doing it. But if you do get up and do stuff, you'd be surprised. Some people, you know, when you smoke a little bit of pot, I'm not saying, you know, it's for everyone, but sometimes that it almost just like opens the window for you, you know.
That's him.
Yeah. I mean, not everyone is like that. Some people smoke pot and they get like, you know, they just don't, I don't know, they get like, I don't know, I mean, you do get hungry. Everybody gets hungry eventually.
Oh,
but,
my God,
yeah,
dude.
You know. Like it just like I would smoke some pot. I'm an anxious person to begin with, so then you know I'm doing push-ups, or I'm doing like I'm on like
I. Do me a favor, bring that mic a little closer to you.
I got to do something, you know.
No, keep going.
But I got to do something. I got to like my energy is like bang, 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 bang. So for me, if I smoke a little bit of pot, like going to the guitar is a natural sort of fit for me.
Yeah.
But I sometimes can't be as. I don't know. Sometimes it, like there's limitations to like how much I can like pull in. I'd rather have that window. It's in its purest form. You're usually not stoned, you know, and then you just kind of write something and then you can get stoned and you can listen to it and be like, oh, that's pretty good, you know. But I wrote this on a day because what happens if you do write that song, it makes your day. You're like, instead of like this day sucking, you're like, dude, I wrote this song. So I'm pretty upset about the state of the world and politics and stuff and raising kids in this sort of state of the world. And I wrote this even before this piece of shit president got elected. But this is it's kind of 99%. It's called The Rich Get Rich. I hope I don't fuck it up. Little Jane, she has her knees. Stage 2 diabetes. Her dad just got laid off. Left me from a trough. Private Ramsey has no hand. Lost in the desert of Sudan. Vate Housewell ain't no home for one nub that cannot roam. Rich y'all getting rich. Paul getting fucked. Turn around, see him. Find some open luck. Rich y'all getting rich. Paul getting fucked. That man just moved up on the hill in his moving truck. Mmm. 50 years, Jim Strickland. Working copper and aluminum. Got no job or security. Living in a trailer outside DC. There's Dung Dishonti Wells. And there it dwells. Shot down in Washington Square. Wearing colors that she never wears. The rich y'all getting rich. Paul getting fucked. Turn around, see him. Find some open look. Rich y'all getting rich. Paul getting fucked. That man just moved up on the hill in his moving truck. Well, if you think this can't be you, you're like an episode of SVU. The time to roll, the time is now. 99% is me and you. Grab your coat and grab your hat. We'll take it back in seconds flat. This albatross has come to rule, has expected both me and you. The rich y'all getting rich. Paul getting fucked. Turn around, see him. Find some open look. Rich y'all getting rich. Paul getting fucked. That man just moved up on the hill in his moving truck. We'll march up to his house. We'll ask him, what the fuck?
Yay!
Hey. Oh my god.
Yeah. So it's not nice, like kids' songs.
That was great.
That was
poor old get hooked. Rich old get rich.
I don't.
Poor old get hooked.
I probably wrote that song 6 or 7 years ago. I'm actually. This is something I didn't know if I was talking. So I'm, much to my wife's dismay, because it's really difficult to get out to do anything. Thanks for having me here today, because, you know, it's like all hands on deck with two toddler twins.
Sure, yeah.
But I really want to write. I've written a bunch of songs, enough to put on an album. I literally don't want to give the album to anybody, or I don't want to promote it, or I just need to put these songs on an album. Just to be done with them in my head, so I can move on and write new songs instead of saying, like, I gotta record those, you know, and just for a blueprint. And also, I think it'd be good to, like, just, I don't know, just to have those songs down somewhere. I don't know. I'm a big recorder. Like, I should, you know, like, if you're gonna, I want to have a transcribed written history about stuff. It just
feels
like,
yeah,
putting it down, you know, allows you to kind of move on. Uh-huh. And it doesn't take up a hard drive in your head anymore.
You're, yeah, because, like, there's only so much room up there.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to move on creatively, then there's stuff that you need to get out of the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're trying to do that, like, professionally in the studio, but if you're not and you're just trying to get it done, I think we'd be happy to set these up in the theater and do it in there.
Thanks.
If you want, if you want to do it.
I've got a guy, the guy I've done the kids' albums with. You know, I'm working on a VO demo. I'm trying to, like, have that as, you know, like, extra things for your submissions and stuff. But in the meantime, while I'm working on that, I'm like, because it's, I'm going to start recording the kids' album maybe 2 or 3 months from now. But so we have some time, because I'm still getting materials together. So I'm trying to get together, you know, once a week or once every couple weeks with him and just record. I got together with him on Thursday, and we did 4 tracks. So it's like, okay, if I do another 4 and another 4, that's 12 songs. And then from there, I can kind of, like, you know, like, okay, this, should I work on these more? Or is this just kind of like, great, it's just, it's guitar, vocals, and it's just, you hear the song, you know?
Right.
Sort of thing. So I don't know exactly.
You should come, me and Brandon are doing, like, a weekly jam session.
Oh, yeah?
If you ever want to come hang.
Okay. You guys both playing the guitar, or?
Yeah. We have a bass as well, so we're sort of splitting it, but yeah, neither of us are bassists, but, you know, you can kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
But, we're just trying to figure out what we want to do with it. We want to start writing eventually, but we're still very early on.
Bro's as far got as a great voice. He's got a great voice.
He does,
he's really, really pretty.
Yeah, he's really pretty.
Yeah. He's mellifluous.
He's
that a word?
He's a pretty boy.
Mellifluous.
Hey, Fish. I almost
called you. Hey, Fish.
Hey, Fish. Yes, sir. Do you have a Scovira segment for us?
History segment?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I feel like we're like on a ball. Do you want to switch to that?
What ball? Yeah.
Or on a roll.
We're on a ball.
We're on a ball.
I don't know. Ball sounds dangerous.
It does sound dangerous.
You can roll off the ball.
We'll get back to it. I just want to break it up a little bit.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, do a history segment. Let's see what here. What you guys got going on? What's the history segment?
So my contribution to this kind of weird thing that we do is I don't know. It's a little bit more like I learned something. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I don't have anything specific that I really thought of. I've been really into parasites. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense.
You know, just like looking at like all the parasitic relationships that exist in nature.
There's so much.
Yeah.
Really, you could say that everything is a parasitic relationship.
That's what I've kind of found because I'm reading this book, as we talked about last week, called Sapiens.
Yeah.
And it talks about like, you know, we as a people are just fucking brutal. Like,
oh, for sure.
Brutal people. But then you look at examples of nature and just like there's this, the tarantula hawk. Are you familiar with the tarantula hawk? It lays its eggs in tarantulas, and then slowly over the course of, like, I think it's 2 months, the babies slowly gestate and then eat their way out of the tarantula.
Video.
And it was... What?
Video, please.
Oh, please, yeah.
So, tarantula hawk.
It's a
hawk.
It's a wasp. It's almost like a hornet.
Why don't they call it a tarantula wasp?
You know, I don't know. Tarantula...
Why are they trying to confuse us with this hawk talk?
I don't know.
Eggs, yeah. Yeah, this is what it looks like.
Wow,
it's terrifying. Yeah, it'll lay its eggs in a tarantula, and then its babies will eat their way out of said tarantula. Yeah, look at that thing.
Wait, so that's the baby.
That's the hawk attacking and probably laying its eggs in this tarantula.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like a wasp.
Let me see a video.
Let me see this video.
Oh, I see one coming out right there.
Yeah, wolf spider drowned by wasp larva.
Is that the same thing?
I mean, it's generally the same.
Tarantula hawk versus tarantula.
Stings versus paralysis. But the reason I found out about it is I was watching Coyote Peterson. Coyote Peterson is I think he's Brave Wilderness, which is his thing. And he rates stings and bites.
Like he
voluntarily gets stung and bitten by things.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a fun job.
Yeah, it's not.
Okay, we got... Whoa.
Yeah,
is that tarantula alive?
I think it's paralyzed.
For people just listening, we have a wasp that is sort of detecting this tarantula, kind of checking the scene, seeing if it's... But the tarantula's kind of playing dead, unless it's...
It's probably already paralyzed.
You think he stung him already?
Oh, he's stinging him right now.
Oh, he's fucking him up.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Turning him over.
Oh, God.
Oh, he's just stinging him all over.
It's kind of like he's raping him.
Yeah, he's like raping him. You're right.
So it kind of is because he's putting his eggs in there. But it's funny because...
Is that the only way to get the offspring?
I would believe so.
A spider? But imagine that. Imagine you're born into a world...
where you have to rape
where the
spider.
Only way to get your offspring produced is to rape another species.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a... a new thing. Like, well, for example, the history behind this is that the researchers that found this tarantula hawk and gave it the name were so disturbed that they like questioned if there was God. Because, like, how could God let this thing exist?
There's so many examples of that.
Yeah. But, like, there's I think it's some sort of another form of larva that will latch itself onto fish's tongues and then devour the tongue and then become a functioning tongue and siphon off blood from the host to live.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have this book at home called The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar. I'll let you.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of it?
No, I can.
It's each chapter is a different example of these types of odd relationships in nature. Between mostly insects, but sometimes animals.
Yeah. So I was like, I was less concerned about like history this week and more like, ugh, we need to like be better to each other.
Yeah. It's funny. The book that you brought up, The Sapiens, I've read a little bit of it too.
Yeah.
I just, I read it and I was really into it, and then I just haven't picked it up again. Mm. But I did it right after Trump got elected because it was, I don't know, I needed to like understand or something. And part of it, you know, and I'd be interested to see what you say about it. Like we're really not that evolved. We jumped this huge, like, man-making fire. All of a sudden, we bypassed all these animals because, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, oh, shit, dude, we can make fire. We can kill anybody, you know? Other animals are like the lions and these gigantic animals that, you know, could beat us, like, hand-to-hand, like, easily. You know, fire all of a sudden gave us this weird advantage, yeah. you know? And so we upset the natural order.
Oh, yeah.
This sort of evolution. I mean, for a long time, you know, humans lived without, like, a blip on the radar. I think the book also talks about, you know, did man cultivate wheat or did wheat cultivate man? I think, and that was an interesting thing, mm-hmm. too, people moving from homesteads and stuff, that we were meant to be hunters and gatherers, you know. And then, you know, and anyway, I thought that was fucking fascinating. I also thought it was fascinating that, you know, even though there was no real connection to it, but most likely what happened to Neanderthals is that we killed them.
We talked about this last week.
Yeah, oh, really? Yeah. Oh, did yeah. you? Like, we killed them. They're dead. And I was like, we didn't like the fact you guys don't talk. So, not cool, guys. You know, some interbred with them, you know, but we probably killed those guys too, yeah. you know. So, you know, for me, and this was like 30,000 years ago, for me, it became like a big sort of, you know, with just the state of the world and specifically with America and other places. It made me feel slightly better at the fact that, like, this is like compassion and shit is a new fucking thing. Mm-hmm. We do not have this ingrained in us. This did not evolve. This is something that's quickly evolving in humans. And a lot of people, you know, whether you're religious or not, I think if anything, I know more agnostic people that practice more compassion than a lot of the Christian people mm-hmm. that I know. You know, but whether you believe in a God or not, or you're spiritual or not, that the act of being compassionate towards one another is rather new. And it would not be that hard to flip the switch back in the other direction.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you put a couple people in kind of a tough situation or something where it's life or fucking death, and we are hardwired to make difficult fucking decisions.
Oh, yeah.
And to kill if we have to. You can be the most compassionate fucking person in the world. The minute your life is somewhat, you know, or your children's lives, or you're not like, wait, I could fucking kill a bitch. I could fucking kill somebody.
Oh, yeah.
I never want to take a life in my life. You know, I've never hunted.
Except in your dreams.
Eat meat. Except in my dreams. I eat meat and stuff, so I'm not, like, you know, I don't kill that meat. You know, I like the middleman to do that.
convenient.
It is. But, you know, that thing could be anything. You know, worrying about someone's safety or survival, when it comes down to you, you could be that again, mm-hmm. quick, I think.
You know? So it's funny because I just read an article with the whole U.S.-Iran thing. Like, how long would it take for America specifically to fall into like that, into like tribalism and complete shit? I'm gonna do a Price is Right style.
Okay.
How long do you think it would take?
Our current situation,
our relationship with the outside world is tanked so much that Iran and all of the Arab countries, basically, the article was talking about like how much time between us not importing new gas, because mm-hmm. that's a lot of our economic thing thrives off of the automobile industry and getting gas so we can transport ourselves. How long, no gas, how long do you think it would take?
I mean, quicker than I think we'd, yeah. I mean, less than 10 years.
Like, give me a...
Like, specifically?
Specifically.
Listen, if, let's say hypothetically that this piece of shit president gets another sort of 4 years. And let's say that this guy doesn't want to go after that 4 years, mm-hmm. which I think even if we elected somebody new, this guy is not going to transfer power easily. He's not going to like losing.
Probably not.
He might try to tank things. This guy is completely predictable and mm-hmm. he's out for himself. So that all those equations being said, and then and we're throwing this other thing into the sort of fryer. I mean, I'd say 5 years that you could like really shit could happen bad.
What do you think?
I don't have an educated guess.
It's 2 months.
Real? If there's no gas.
There's no gas.
2 months and everything goes to shit.
According to what, this article?
According to a hypothetical, because think about all the things that you depend on. Food, water, electricity.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I could see it being that
2 months
quick.
2 months of us not having any more imported.
Of any, like, so nothing, so we're using our own fuel reserves. Whatever's in the gas station down the corner, that's going to run out in a week.
Right.
So you're going to have to keep searching for things, keep searching. Power plants shut off.
Yeah, I believe that. It'd be dire.
So what happens next if that ends?
Tribalism. People start looting. You start seeing economic collapse. People just start fucking going out on their own. Like, how do you get around? You have to walk, or you rely on electrical energy, but then, like, you know, who's in charge of those plants? Because, like, yeah, the chain of command happens, but what happens when the plant workers can't get to work? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would, it would devolve very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
What's the saving grace in that situation?
There is none.
You say that's it. We're done if that happens.
So if you can't feed yourself, you can't, you know, go to work and find something, like, what are you going to do? You have to eat.
Dude, and most people in LA don't have an earthquake kit, much less have they thought about what would happen in a situation like this. And I don't think it's as far off. I mean, definitely, like, 4 years ago, I would have been like, that's not going to happen, dude.
Yeah.
But now, like, I don't know.
I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think, like, it's going to happen. But I'm saying, I could see how one thing, how it could have a domino effect, and it could be super dire in a short amount of time where you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, just specifically, I mean, this person that doesn't deserve the title, who was elected through nefarious means, and Facebook is to blame for
that. Gil, are you a Democrat?
I am. I do not. And I apologize if any of you guys are on the other side. I welcome healthy debate, but I do not. I think this guy's a cancer, and I really hate him.
Would you call him a parasite?
He is a parasite.
You have to look into camera.
He is a parasite. He very much is that. He's a parasite. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't. So who do you like on the other side? I'm very weird.
I would
about
vote
going
for
this direction.
I honestly would vote for fucking Kanye before I'd vote for him. And I fucking hate Kanye.
In all seriousness, who do you like that's running right now?
I like Warren and I like Sanders. I think if Biden gets the vote, I'm fine with that. I'm not. You know, so I'll vote for any Democrat, like anyone. I'll vote for any Democrat. You know,
Miriam Williams. Or Marianne Williams?
If she had gotten the
nomination, would have voted for Kamala Harris?
I would have voted for anybody is better than this guy. Like, anybody is better than this guy. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's a cult. And I don't know how other people, like, just don't see it.
You don't think that your side's a cult?
I don't need one person, you know? They want Trump. Like, I don't need one person.
Who's they?
I mean, the Republicans. I mean,
Republicans don't like Trump.
So then why not say it? You're scared.
Because they don't want to give the power up to the left.
They're cowards, dude.
Well, the thing is just like how you're saying anyone's better than Trump, and their opinions on the other side is that they don't like Trump, but he's better than any of the Democrats.
Because they
want to maintain power for the next Republican to come in.
Sure, I get that. But they have stuff on these guys. And that's why. On all the RNC.
On Trump?
Yeah. They hacked in the DNC and the RNC. They don't. They threw all the emails out for the DNC. What do you think they did with the emails for the RNC? They're holding as like leverage for all these Republicans. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's they hacked both of them. You don't hear anything about the Republican emails. You know, it's because they're holding them for leverage. That's my take on it.
Yeah, off the mic, we can continue this.
Yeah, yeah.
I swore to myself that I would not allow this podcast to go in those directions
it's too divisive.
It's so complicated.
Yoshi supports terrorism. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, apparently loves him.
Hey man, we're not supposed to tell anyone.
Gets in bed with him.
Just loves him.
Actually, I was watching Merchants of Doubt last night. Have you guys seen that?
Uh-huh. No, what's that about?
I didn't finish it, but it's essentially about this rather small group of individuals who may or may not have any relationship towards each other, but who have appeared decade after decade as basically gun-for-hire propagandists to save different corporations. So starting with tobacco, essentially they are shills put in place to create doubt, because once doubt exists, mm-hmm. then people don't know what to believe, kind right. of thing. So they created doubt whether or not tobacco was addictive. That right. was sort of the first plant. And then that would carry over to like asbestos and flammable retardants and all these chemical companies. And there it is. And then all the way to climate change and the uh-huh. greenhouse effect, when that was starting in the 80s. Like, there was this one scientist who started talking about that. And then so some of these merchants of doubts who were fighting for the tobacco industry 10 years later were seen creating doubt in climate change.
Right.
And so this documentary mm-hmm. showcases these people and basically just...
That's interesting.
Yeah, just really merchants enlightens... how propaganda works in the modern world.
I mean, you can go even further, and you can talk about, I mean, you brought it up too, the Facebooks of the world, and people will believe anything that you put in front of them now. Like, I've seen multiple relatives of mine share Onion articles because they're like, oh, this proves my point. I agree with it. Yeah, I don't have to do any sort
Isn't
of research.
Isn't Onion
it's satirical?
Fake, but it's known. It's like they don't try to hide it.
Yes.
Yeah, but you see a headline that's like, you know, Hillary eats babies to, you know, further her life. Yeah. And they're like, oh, I knew it.
Well, that's the problem.
Well, if you're being fooled by an Onion article,
they don't consider the source. They're not looking at the source.
Yeah.
They're looking that's at the things problem, that validate their belief. Yeah. They're looking at things that like substantiate what they already believe. So my wife and I did this. It was like a couple's retreat. It was called the Gottman Institute. And one of the things that a lot of great ways of working through tensions and stuff, because as you can imagine, like, we're fine. Actually, the 2 days we were away from the kids, we had a sitter with them. It was great. It's like, oh, yeah, we're good. You know, it's just mm-hmm. when you have two kids grabbing at you the whole time, it's like, can you help me out? Like, there's just that becomes tension, you know? Right. And but one of the things mm-hmm. that he talks about, and he had this great story, which is what kind of lends itself to it. But it was like, he's Jewish. And so he said the story that he had was like, there was a rabbi and then a younger rabbi kind of watching. And there was a couple that came, an older couple. And the wife kind of comes in. They both meet with him, and the wife comes in, and she's just like going on and on and on about her husband and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, and then the rabbi says, you know what? You're absolutely right.
Gil, do me a favor and bring this mic up.
You're absolutely right. You do so much for your husband, and he doesn't know how good you are and all that stuff. And she's like, yeah, okay, thank you. I really appreciate that. Then the other husband comes in, and he goes on and on about his wife. And, you know, and the rabbi listens, and, you know, and at the end of the husband, he was like, you are absolutely right. You know, she doesn't know that you bring in, you know, all this sort of, you know, all the successes to your house, you know, with your employment and everything else. And so then he leaves, and then the young rabbi that's with him is like, okay, I'm kind of confused because I heard both of those, and, you know, they can't both be right. Mm-hmm. And then the rabbi says to him, you know what? You're absolutely right.
Huh.
Which is like, there's always two sides to the story.
Yes.
And both sides are right. So we as people, and especially with the propaganda that we get on Facebook and everything else, we're looking for information that substantiates how we feel about a certain situation. Yeah. Because especially in our anger, the thing that's anger is so seductive for men is because in some women, when you're angry, you're positive you're right. And you don't have this sort of like, you've almost kind of like, it's another thing I learned at the Gottman, you've almost maxed out. They call it like when your hormones and you're mm-hmm. in a discussion with somebody, a lover or whatever, like you'll flood. Your head will flood because your heart goes over like 100 beats a minute and you don't make sense. You can't, like, you almost just need to take a break.
Right.
Because you'll just like, you're like, I can't say anything that's not going to be hurtful or whatever else. Yeah. And I think in some people, like whether it's politics or whatever else, they flood and they have this sort of anger, you know.
It's actually called an amygdala hijack is what happens.
Okay.
When you're confronted with the fact that you're wrong, uh-huh. it goes into that flight or flight
instinct. Yeah.
That, like, you're going to, no, I'm right. Even though in the back of your mind, in the non-lizard brain that you have, it's like, oh, no, I could be wrong about this.
Like when you and I were arguing about the definition of of protagonist. Wow.
Fuck yourself.
Well, no, that we were both, I just spit all over this. We were both displaying what you just said.
To be fair, I'm right.
What are you talking about? Didn't we come to the conclusion that...
No! I let you win because I wanted to continue the show. Okay.
Oh, God.
So we're both reptiles.
Go. In a documentary,
do
you call the main focus of the story?
Well, that's not a fair way to phrase...
That's exactly how it was doing.
The main focus of the story
is...
the protagonist.
God damn it.
I'm out. See you guys.
God fucking... Oh my!
The protagonist, but
why?
I mean, that's the protagonist. But okay, so here's an interesting thing. I just heard this recently. Morgan Freeman, in a lot of the movies that he's in, he's not actually like in Shawshank Redemption. You consider him the lead.
No, I wouldn't.
You consider Tim Robbins.
Yeah.
Even though he has less screen time. Because everything is through the eyes towards Tim Robbins. He's the vessel for the protagonist. Because Tim Robbins, you know, but I think he's actually got more time. Another interesting thing.
Yeah.
You know, this is like a, So in the play Amadeus. Amadeus is the sort of, it's about him.
Yeah.
Right? But Salieri opens and closes the show, and really, it's about Salieri and Salieri's jealousy of Mozart. Is Mozart the protagonist, or is Salieri the protagonist?
Well, in that case, I would say Salieri is the protagonist, because he in the framing of that movie... Well, no, I guess that's the same for Shawshank, too, because in the framing of the movie, he's talking about Amadeus... But he's doing it from the sense of he's telling his grandchildren or something.
Uh-huh. But I don't think we're talking about Amadeus. First, I went to Morgan Freeman and how in Shawshank Redemption, because he's the protagonist as Tim Robbins. But you know, it starts with Morgan Freeman. Like it's all through Morgan Freeman.
Sure.
So then I quickly jumped to Amadeus. How sometimes it didn't, you know, how
great movie.
Mozart, it was a great movie. Mozart, I would consider the protagonist, you know, but... the movie's about Salieri, and it's like opens and closes with Salieri. So I don't know if that holds true completely. That whatever your intro line is, just to give a little bit of breathing room.
Well, I don't think the word protagonist can pertain to a documentary because they are not a fictional person. Does that make sense?
I think where our argument stems from is that I'm more of the belief that protagonist isn't necessarily married to fiction. Protagonist is just the carrier of the story, or whoever's on the hero's journey, or whoever we're watching develop, or the main focus is the protagonist of the story. And documentaries are stories, even though they're not fictional.
Yeah.
So in a football game, there's a protagonist.
Not really, because that's a game. The protagonist would change depending on what team you're a fan of. If you're a fan of the New England Patriots, then the protagonists are the Patriots, and the antagonists are the Tennessee Titans.
Does that make it like it has to be a positive?
And also, a football game's not a story.
It is a story.
I think you're pushing
It's a developing story. The protagonist
It's a game. It's not a story.
It could switch. The guy who made the winning touchdown could all of a sudden be like, he takes the light. You know?
But what happens if...
Well, there could be a story within a game, I suppose. Yeah.
No.
Yes. But I think we're getting into
semantics.
We're getting into semantics this year. But my thing was like, so we talked about this documentary where this person, you know, faces all this hardship, so we're not going to bring it up again. But I don't think that they're the protagonist. We are just viewing their life. But I guess that makes sense because, like, we're framing it around, like, it's truth.
When I was watching this documentary...
It's a focal point.
It's a focal point, yeah. And this argument, you just need to bow and accept that you've lost. Now,
hey, here's another thing. Both sides are right.
Yeah.
You're both right.
But that's the thing is I understand your point.
No, but you're a rat bastard and you need to die.
Well, yeah. I'm working on it.
Both of you.
We're gonna do our fish segment in a moment right here. Gil, what we do here is this list that I've compiled is every song that the band Fish, who my audience knows by now, I'm obsessed with.
Are you?
Yeah, a little
you
bit.
Don't say.
Yeah, I just saw them two nights in a row in New York for Madison Square Garden.
I didn't know you were a Fish.
I've been to like 25 shows.
That was the first time I took acid was when I went to see Fish.
You've seen Fish?
Oh yeah, dude.
Wow. So now you
several times.
See, it's not coincidence that this theater several troupe's gotten times together because when somebody has been to a Fish show, like a certain window opens up for me in my relationship with them. As silly as that sounds,
what?
But what's crazy is you've been to Fish. Brandon's been to Fish and Chad's been to Fish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like Fish. Chris, I like Fish a lot.
Gotta catch up.
I'm apparently the weird fucking guy out.
You like Fish?
Yeah, a lot. I like Divided Sky. Yeah, I have Junta. I have a lot of their albums.
This is amazing.
I used to be like when college, that was a big thing.
Yeah, I just saw them for New Year's and
I've been going through Hoist again lately.
Really?
Yeah, in fact, you know, some of the albums, like Billy Breeze has, that was when I first did Summerstock in 97. That album just transports me back.
So good.
To that. Yeah, yeah.
I love that album.
Really pretty.
Very pretty.
And Hoist is great. I've been going back for that. Rift is really good.
Mm-hmm.
Although that... and when you're there, I sleep lengthwise. And when you're gone, I sleep diagonal in my bed. And when you're there, I sleep lengthwise. And it goes into like that
maze.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like Creed's Weathered album. I think it's pretty good.
Oh my goodness, Christ. So basically, what we do here in this segment is. You can take your time if you'd like. Chris and I can talk. But you look through that. I mean, you're more familiar than most, I guess, would be. And you pick a song, whether you're familiar with it or not. I'll leave that up to you. Chris is going to pull up the lyrics. And essentially, you have the stage to do whatever you want to do with your interpretation of your performance of these lyrics. So you could recite it as a poem if it calls for that. If you want to pick up your guitar, you can do that. If you want to just say it, you can do that. We had Paul, someone on here who did like a really animated theatrical rendition of it.
Uh-huh.
We've had somebody who just read it because that's all they wanted to do. But so look through that and pick whatever connects to you, and let us know when you're ready.
Yeah,
Chris, did you have anything else on the Parasite or was that? Did we basically cover that?
I didn't really prepare a lot for that this week. I was more focused on the tech side.
That's
and
fine.
I've taken actually. This entire week was the first time since last Friday, since Brandon's thing, I haven't drank.
Mm,
it's really? Been
amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good for you.
How many days is this now?
8, including That's great. This one.
And you feel good?
I feel wonderful.
Do you think you're done for a while?
I think I'm good for like a... I'm going to probably do a month and then see how I feel.
Yeah.
Just because like... I mean, I've noticed in my health and like I can actually sleep through the night, which is nice.
Mm, isn't it amazing?
And then I start taking, at your recommendation, MCT oil as well.
Yeah.
So that coupled with the not drinking is like really great.
I'm glad to hear it, man.
Like I don't...
You're still smoking though?
I do edibles. I don't smoke as much anymore.
Uh-huh.
I do like 2.5 a night just to like go to sleep.
Yeah.
But
do you feel groggy in the morning or anything?
No.
Is no effects
I actually,
the next day?
Weirdly enough, I normally like will pound an energy drink or like I'll get like caffeine pills the entire week. I haven't done anything.
Oh, so you just haven't felt the need for that second push. So it was mostly the alcohol that was sort of...
Pretty much. And I've like, even my, like, I mean, you can't really see it on this, but, like, my stomach has, like, shrunk, like, an inch or two.
Yeah.
And then I weighed myself at the gym earlier today, and I've lost 10 pounds.
Seriously? In 8 days?
In 8 days.
Oh, my God.
I drank a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I remember a good Saturday for me was going to get... This is going to make me seem like a douchebag... I would get a 12-pack of a knockoff version of White Claw because White Claw is too expensive. Drink all of it.
Oh my God.
And then order a pizza or like my Postmates is like a lot. So, yeah.
So did drinking usually lead to you eating unhealthy or is that a separate?
It led to a lot of things. It led to me doing stupid being rash. Shit, just being rash, Amazoning things.
Yeah.
But like this morning, I called you during like just a bit of just, you know, oh, I'm doing things. I cleaned my entire apartment.
You felt a little more energetic.
I was super energetic. Yeah.
Got one?
Sure.
Yeah. All right.
Down with disease.
Down with disease. Okay.
Down with disease.
It's an interesting. Yeah, let's go. So far, everybody's been picking very obscure ones.
Bathtub Gin. I haven't heard that song in a long time.
Oh, love Bathtub. I like that song. Yeah.
And Free is really good.
Yep.
I mean, they're all really. Divided Sky. I almost did Divided Sky.
The wind blows high, my friend.
Uh huh.
So here is the lyrics for Down with Disease. So feel free to do whatever you want. I'll track with your reading.
Don't feel obligated, but I just looked up the chords and it's pretty simple.
Really?
Yeah, it's just A for the verse, and then the chorus is A G D. So A is waiting for the time when G I can finally D say. But I mean that I don't want to put that pressure on you. Here, I'll show it to you.
To make it bigger.
Fuck, I just hopefully I didn't lose all of my data. It was good. Make it bigger, you said?
Yeah, so you can see it.
So the verse is just A.
Yeah. I can probably say this all been wonderful. Now I'm on my way.
Well, you don't have to perform it, it's your interpretation.
Well, you can though if you'd like to. Me and Chris will keep talking until you're ready.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great to hear. As you know, I'm sort of combating, not combating, but
yeah.
I've fallen. I've made a conscious decision to stop smoking.
Smoking dope.
Smoking the dopes. After New Year's, and I fell back into it two times since New Year's, and both times my conscience got super heavy.
Oh yeah.
He saw me last night. Wasn't good. I really beat myself up last night.
That last night?
For smoking, I know.
That was on Thursday.
Oh, Thursday, yeah. I know, it sounds weird, but I really have made a choice to give that up.
Yeah.
And it sounds like loop, like hippy-dippy, but these two times that I caved and smoked since New Year's, my conscience, it's just not... It doesn't work. It's not working right now.
Yeah.
And I just need to listen to that.
Yeah, take a break, yeah.
And just, yeah. But I'm conflicted because I relate to what you brought up earlier about, and he even chimed in with something about how it opens me up creatively.
Yeah.
And I think it really opens my personality up big time. Yeah. But I haven't been able to, since New Year's at least, and there's been times before, which is what led into this decision. Two things. I my willpower to not eat a ton of food is just I'm two different people. Yeah. When I'm sober, I'm this personality, and when I smoke, any agreements that I made before are like God. I'm this person who's just like, dude, like it, who gives a fuck if you eat this pizza? Sorry to spit. And where I'm at right now is I can't tell if it's the weed or the food that I'm eating late at night. It's probably a combination. But my next day, I cannot wake up. I'm sleepwalking all day.
Really?
All day. I think it's because I've allowed myself to get very, very healthy and see what it feels like to be my fully optimized version. Yeah. And so now I know what that looks like. I know how that brain space feels.
Yeah.
And so now if I'm even one iota below that, I've become very self-conscious and of it. And I can't get as much done. And then that just, it's just like a snowball effect.
Uh-huh.
So you're giving up alcohol. I'm giving up weed.
Yeah. But I think it's going to lead us kind of realize that higher version of ourselves that doesn't require some sort of substance to activate. I think a lot of my personal problems with my forms of addiction were you know, you don't like the person that you are when you're just you. And that's mm-hmm. that's the thing you need to do. Not that I'm saying that you need to do that, but like you need to realize that the person and the creative being that you are just needs a little push, and it doesn't have to be weed.
Yeah, and if you could just trust that, yeah. And, yeah, I know what you
it
mean.
It might not be giving you the same stuff, too. I mean, for me, I struggle with drinking. In fact, on Christmas Eve, my aunt, not my aunt, but my wife's aunt was there, and she's like a recovering addict, I guess. Mm-hmm. And she was like, it was like 11:30, and I poured myself a drink. It's Christmas Eve. But then, and I guess she felt like I needed to hear it, but she was like, you have a drinking problem. You know, I was like, oh, you're in my, okay.
You're in my house.
Yeah, but I was like, it was valid, and she felt, I'm glad that she felt like she could say that to mm-hmm. me, you know. It's nothing that I haven't thought to myself, you know. But it was like, and I walked her out, and then it occurred to me, is like, you know, I was like, I just drink to like unwind and stuff. She's like, but is that really the truth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, so one, it's a habit. I'm predisposed to have this habit. And also, I have no other, no way of working through this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how to eliminate stresses. My first instinct is to go have a drink. And I don't have the stresses anymore. You know, I'm just like, ah, great, feel good. I have them the next day because I failed myself again.
Right.
You know, which is kind of what you were talking about.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, man.
Yeah, it's because by itself, like, having a couple hits of weed, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
What's wrong is that you made an agreement with yourself, and now you've broken that agreement.
You've broken the trust within yourself.
Yeah.
I also think that I never wake up in the morning and say like, oh, I guess I used to if I partied really bad, but since I've had kids, I'm never like waking up to like have an eye opener or something. And if I had like a big party night or some, you know, drugs were involved, whatever, like I could wake up like this, I have a beer at a Mexican place, but I don't do that, you know. But by the end of the day, even if I've told myself I'm not going to drink today by like 7:30 or 8, if it's been a stressful day, you know, it's like I kind of want it. And part of it, there's almost a scientific study that it takes your brain a long time. You're constantly fighting off impulses throughout the course mm-hmm. of the day. You're constantly like, no, don't do that. No, don't do that. No, don't try to kiss her. No, don't slap. You know, constantly like, yeah. No, don't tell her, shut the fuck up. Like you're constantly doing it. So by the end of the day, you're exhausted. And so the idea that you are going to like not give yourself what you want is counterintuitive. The only time you recognize that you've done well, you know, is if you can not listen to that voice, you know, and somehow the next day you will profit from it. You'll be like,
that morning feels great.
Mm-hmm.
I did okay.
Yeah.
And it gives you enough confidence to try it another day. You know, it's all about having a run. It's like, it's literally everything is about having a run. You'll get to a month and you're going to be like, I haven't had a drink in a month. Like, I want to go another month.
There's
a rhythm to it.
There's a rhythm. There's a science to why you get chips.
Yeah. Well, and I think my aunt had said when I walked out to the car, she's like, I hope you weren't upset. I was like, I mean, no. It's like, I needed to hear
it.
It was unsolicited, but I needed to hear it. And she's like, you know what? If you know, you might not be ready, and I don't know if I am. But she goes, I have a feeling that when you do it, you're gonna wish you did it sooner, and you're not gonna have missed anything.
Damn,
you know.
Powerful. Which,
yeah, I bet she's right.
It's powerful.
So I don't know this song, but I know a little bit. Amanda, down with disease, 3 weeks in my bed, trying to stop these demons that keep dancing in my head. Down with disease, up before the dawn, 1,000 barefoot children outside, dancing on my lawn. Waiting for the time when I can finally say, this has all been wonderful, now I'm on my way. When I think it's time to leave it all behind, I try to find a way, but there's nothing I can say to make it stop. Stop, 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 stop. What's that lick? Well, here, this is a go.
Riff.
Riff, that's a riff. I'll do it two more time. Down with disease, the jungle's in my mind. They're climbing up my waterfalls, swinging on my vines. So I try to hear the music, but I'm out of time, 'cause they're stepping on my rhythm. stealing all my lines. Dun, 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 dun. Waiting for a time when I can finally say, this has all been wonderful, but now I'm on my way. When I think it's time to leave it all behind, try to find a way, but there's nothing I can say to make it stop, 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 stop. Does it keep on going on? Is there more?
That's it.
Oh, Jesus.
Let's do it again without the guitar, and let's just let's harmonize it, you and me.
Down with disease.
And then the end of the segment is we see if we can decode a little bit of.
We are at 5:40, by the way.
All right, this will be the end. Here. Here we go.
Can we go up to the top?
Oh yes, everybody.
I'll follow you.
Okay. Down with disease. 3 weeks in my bed, trying to stop these demons that keep dancing in my head. Down with Z, I'm up before the dawn. 1,000 barefoot children outside, dancing on my lawn. And I keep waiting for the time when I can finally say, this has all been wonderful, but now I'm on my way. When I think it's time to leave it all behind, try to find a way, but there's nothing I can say to make it stop. Stop, 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 stop. Down with disease, the jungle's in my mind, climbing up my waterfalls and swinging on my vines. So I try to hear the music, but I'm always losing time, stepping on my rhythm and stealing all my lines. Stealing all my lines, and I keep waiting for the time when I can finally say, this has all been wonderful, but now I'm on my way. When I think it's time to leave it all behind, try to find a way, but there's nothing I can say to make it stop. Stop, 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 stop.
Hey, man, stop.
Jesus Christ.
When I was at this concert, man, it was the first time I ever took acid. It was 1994. My Sherpa in my acid trip, this guy Jason, he was another fellow actor. We went out. They did the beach ball thing.
What's a Sherpa?
You know, like a Sherpa. Like, he's like, hey, man, take it. We'll take it together.
Like, is your shaman, like your guy.
Yeah, you know. Oh. And then, you know, hey, if you're having a bad trip, whatever. And I had a great time,
come
you know.
Find me on the mountain.
And they're like laughing.
It's important to have someone like that, especially in that type of an environment. Because there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of data around you. And you could easily just get way overloaded.
And they did the beach ball. And so each time it hit somebody, it's like, bink, 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 bink. And it was just like, oh, my God.
Oh, they were making sound effects?
Yeah, yeah, with the beach ball. So that's the beach ball lands. Ding.
Do you remember what show this was?
Like, it's 94 in Knoxville. No, I don't know what they were.
94 in Knoxville?
94 in Knoxville.
All right, go ahead. I'm going to find out.
And it was just like great, man. And in fact, so at the second, what I thought was the second intermission, I was like sitting on like, it's like, oh, just mind blown.
The Knoxville Civic Auditorium?
Yeah.
April 25th, 1994.
Yeah, that's about right. I was just like mind blown.
Here's the set, Yosh.
Bouncing around the room, the Divided Sky. Just mind blown, and they split open and melt. I was like, I need a break after that.
Wow. Ooh, the curtain. That's my favorite opener, man. Oh, I've never seen it. I've never seen the curtain.
What happened?
Why are you stepping on things, man?
Did I step on it?
No, I think it was you.
But at one point,
yeah,
I guess after the second, we left the second time, and I was like, is there more? And the guy I was with, Jason, was like, no, man, it's over.
that's when you know.
Oh, and then we went back to his place. It was a night of first, and we did Whippets. I'd never done Whippets before.
Whippets?
Whippets on
acid.
So
not balloons, but actual Whippets?
Yeah, Whippets. Like, he might have, maybe it was in a balloon, but it was like canisters, you know? And like,
helium.
It was cool. It was really cool.
Nitrous.
Yeah. And that was another sort of experience where, like, this was a new group. It was some young guys. They were undergraduates. There was one MFA guy from Knoxville. This guy Mike Gobleski, and then Jason Walton, I think was his name is. He moved to Chicago, but you know, it's just like, oh, this is my tribe. This is cool. You know, it was like another sort of like affirming sort of thing.
That's
that drugs weren't like totally bad. You know,
No, they can be, if used for good, they can be very heart-opening. That same tribe thing that you had when you found your acting troupe, that was me with fish.
Oh, really?
100%. I became a dirty little hippie for a few summers.
Did you?
Uh-huh. But that was the same thing.
Did you, like, make grilled cheeses and shit? You kind
of
do that?
I didn't get to that, to the Wook status of making grilled cheeses, but I
saw The Grateful Dead in 94, too.
Wow. With Jerry.
With Jerry. And it was, we drove... I think, was it Jason that drove you? I don't know. But we drove maybe to Ohio or something to see the Dead, and I was able to catch them. Traffic opened up for them, Steve Winwood's band. It had been long. It was awesome, dude. It was awesome. But just to see that sort of like culture, it was great.
How would you compare the two? Because people always compare Fish to Grateful Dead, and I've seen the Dead with John Mayer, and there's certainly nothing like Fish, but I'm wondering...
I think the Dead, for me, I mean, it was just that one show, but it's just like, I don't know, like what they're doing, it's almost like you're leaning in to kind of catch what they're doing, you know, because it's just so like atmospheric almost, you know. Fish is
leaning in is a great way to put it.
You know, you're just kind of like, this is solo, or there's just something very, almost like a jazz ensemble would be, just like there's no fucking hurry. Like, you know, I remember, and I still to this day, like, you know, I probably took acid. I wouldn't take it anymore, but, you know, in my 20s, maybe a dozen times or whatever, maybe more than that. I don't know. But I remember, if you're ever feeling bad, put on some Grateful Dead. Like, the Dead will make you, it'll be fine. Everything's fucking fine. And that's just the groove that they give you. You're just like, and I couldn't always say that about Fish. I love Fish, but, you know, like, they've got some lyrics where you're like, if you're teetering on the edge, you're like, dude, I need to hear some different music. I need some shit just to calm me the fuck down a little bit.
They've got some challenging stuff.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For
sure. If you take a psychedelic at a Fish show and you're not privy to what goes on there,
yeah,
you're going on an odyssey.
Yeah, you could,
because they go, they got highs, they got lows, they got,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But yeah, they, Fish is jazz, basically. That's what it is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what they're doing. I actually, that first album, I did a job in Rhode Island, and I found out that their first venue that they did, that they kind of performed in, was right down the road. So I wanted to go and check it out, and they, you know, had like, yeah, Fish performed here, whatever else. I was like, this is where they're from, dude. This is where they're from.
Dude, New Year's was insane.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Bet. They do gags every New Year's.
Yeah.
And this year they were, each member of the band came out and they did an a cappella version of Send in the Clowns.
Uh-huh.
But they changed the word clowns to clones.
Uh-huh.
And then when the song ended, they all had jumpsuits on, like Ninja Turtle jumpsuits, but not Ninja Turtles, but colored jumpsuits. After they finished the acapella, they all went to the front of the stage and got on these four platforms, each on their own platform with their instruments already on there, and the platform was colored to their jumpsuit.
Uh-huh.
And they raised to the top of Madison Square Garden, and then all of these clones came out onto the empty stage, like 50 mics, 50 trays, 50 pages, and 50 Fishmans. And they just started doing these synchronized dances to the whole set while Fish was at the top of Madison Square Garden playing down to us. And then Trey got stuck in real life. All the platforms came down except for Trey's, like halfway through the set. And Trey just had to play the rest of the set from the top of Madison Square
Garden
by himself. And he was stuck. And at the end of the show, they had to send these guys up like to save him. And he started, he's up there by himself, the rest of the band's backstage already, and they send these guys up to save him, and Trey being Trey just started to improvise a song while he's being saved, and he's like, Rescue Squad. Rescue Squad.
Well, I know he liked to perform high, but I didn't know literally he wanted to do it.
He's sober though.
I heard that.
Yeah.
I heard he's a big Coke guy for a while.
He was a big pill guy from what I have gathered, but I'm sure Coke was involved.
Yeah, once you're doing that, you got to eat an up from that down, and then you get down from that up.
Yeah, it just becomes a
It's a constant vicious elevator. Cycle.
Can you pull those lyrics back up? I just want to do us justice and try to do some kind of decoding of it.
You're running slow.
I know. We got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Dude, they encored with Amazing Grace and Bold as Love at the show you were at. That's incredible. Amazing. You were probably like, oh.
I do remember that. Bold as Love.
Just ask the accent. Okay, so down with disease, 3 weeks in my bed, trying to stop these demons that keep dancing in my head. Okay, that's pretty that self-explanatory. Like a fever. Yeah, fever or a drug. I've
probably done those barefoot children outside dancing like eat.
1,000 barefoot children outside dancing on my lawn. I always felt like when I was at the shows, especially in the early days when I was on the lawn, that that was like a reference just to us, to the audience. You know, like, 1,000 barefoot children outside dancing on my lawn. We're on their lawn and we're dancing on their on their property, waiting for the time when I can finally say that this has all been wonderful, but now I'm on my way. This always makes me feel my microphone falling apart over here. But like just like what we were just talking about, like with in life, like you read a metaphorical book enough times, it's time to put that book down because you've gotten the lesson.
Yeah.
So I had that experience with mushrooms, like. I did mushrooms. I wasn't an acid guy. I was more of a mushrooms guy. And there was, like, the last couple times I did mushrooms, like, years ago, my experience was sort of clouded with this voice saying, like, hey, man, put the phone down. You got the message.
Yeah. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We don't need you here anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that could go with the weed for me right now or the alcohol for you. It's like, it's all been wonderful, but it's time to take it off. When I think it's time to leave it all behind, I try to find a way, but there's nothing I can say to make it stop. I mean, it's pretty appropriate for our discussion. Now, with disease and the jungles in my mind, they're climbing up my waterfalls and swinging on my vines.
So I try to hear the music, but I'm always losing time because they're stepping on my rhythm, they're stealing all my lines.
Who is they?
The thoughts.
Yeah.
The non-do-gooders.
The versions of me that are...
The old versions.
...are no longer serviced.
The clones.
The clones.
The old versions of you.
The
old versions of you that want you to stay you. Don't buck
you. Yes, that want you to stay you.
Don't be you.
Don't change.
Don't change. That means we got to work.
That means we got to leave. We got to die.
Yeah.
We got to die.
You can't be that way anymore.
Yeah. Because you changing means you dying. Guilford the Clown...
Hey, thanks, guys.
Thank you
good
for coming on, man.
Good to see you.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, really appreciate you coming on. Hey, we have about 3 minutes. Can we finish with another kid song?
Sure.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
It's really time to finish.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to record you.
Here we go. You ready?
I'm ready.
I got skunky blues. How do you do? I got the skunky blues. How do you do? Being a skunk ain't no fun if it's all that you can do. I wear my fur all black with a white stripe down my back. I wear my fur all black with a white stripe down my back. Well, you want to look, but you better step back. I got one grandson who looks just like I do. I got one grandson who looks just like I do. Being a skunk ain't no fun if it's all that you can do. Now, boys and girls, I'm going to teach you how to do this skunk. It's pretty easy. All you got to do is pinch your nose and shake that tail. I said, boys and girls, pinch your nose and shake that tail. I said, boys and girls, pinch your nose and shake that tail. Woo! I got skunky blues, how do you do? I got a skunky blues, how do you do? Being a skunk ain't no fun if it's all that you can do. Ha-cha-cha-cha-cha.